Welcome to A Contra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Contra AI.
Jonathan Safran Foer, he really just burst onto the scene in 2002 with his debut novel, Everything is Illuminated. It gave us this really distinctive and immediate new voice in contemporary American literature.
It's incredible, isn't it, how it just immediately sort of carved out its own category?
Yeah.
We're not just talking about historical fiction here. This novel is a true genre hybrid.
It really is.
It blends a road trip story with, you know, the devastating history of the Holocaust, and then it's all wrapped up in this playful, postmodern, almost metafictional structure.
And that structure, that connection, is exactly what we want to get into in this deep dive. We're going to follow these two parallel stories, look at how they're bound together, and grapple with some really profound themes. Guilt, memory, the very nature of truth itself.
So to set the scene, we meet a young Jewish American writer who's also named Jonathan Safran Foer.
A choice that immediately blurs the lines, right?
Okay, exactly. It's the first clue that this isn't going to be a straightforward story.
Yeah.
So he travels to Ukraine in 1997, and all he has with him is a single, faded photograph.
And his quest is so personal, but it's also rooted in this huge collective memory. He's looking for a woman named Augustine.
Right. The woman he believes saved his grandfather, Safran, from the Nazis in a forgotten Jewish shtetl called Trachimbrod.
He's basically looking for a hero, for a clear, complete story of salvation that he can hold on to.
And to find her, he hires this truly unforgettable trio from the Perchoff family.
Unforgettable is definitely the word.
You have Alex Perchoff, the translator. He's obsessed with American pop culture, and his English is, well, it's hilariously mangled.
Gloriously flawed.
Yes. And then there's his grandfather, who's the driver. He's this cantankerous old man who claims to be blind. And of course, their flatulent CI bitch, Sammy Davis Jr.
And the genius here is how that almost farcical comedy sets up the novel's entire structure. You have the road trip, told mostly through Alex's letters, written in what he calls his premium English.
And running right alongside that, you have Jonathan's own writing, a fictionalized, almost magical realist history of Trachimbrod that starts way back in 1791.
So these two narratives, the modern funny journey and the mythic tragic history, they're what make the novel such a powerful statement on memory and storytelling. But the blurring of the author's name with the characters, that's more than just a trick, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's postmodern metafiction at its core. It forces you, the reader, to realize you're reading a constructed story about constructing stories.
So the central conflict isn't just about finding Augustine.
No, it's about whether the perfect heroic story Jonathan is searching for can even exist in the face of such an atrocity.
And Alex's voice becomes so important there. His malapropisms, all his creative mistakes with English. They're funny, yes, but they're doing serious work.
They really are. They're a constant reminder of the limits of language itself. I mean, when he promises to discover the truth on the tip of my pen, the book is quietly asking if any language, perfect or not, can truly contain the horror of what happened.
It's just so striking how Foer uses that comedy to set up the emotional gravity to come. So if the structure is about truth and flawed language, how does that play out in the character's own journeys? Let's start with Jonathan.
Well, Jonathan begins as this almost passive figure, a collector. He literally carries Ziploc bags for every little scrap of paper or bit of soil.
He's trying to package his family's trauma.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He wants to organize it into this neat, clean narrative that he can understand from a safe distance.
But the journey itself is his illumination, for lack of a better word. He's forced out of that detached role.
He has to become an active participant.
Yeah.
And he learns that truth isn't some neat artifact you can put in a bag. It's messy, it's painful, and it's deeply ambiguous.
And then you have Alex Perchoff. His transformation is, I think, the emotional anchor of the whole story.
I'd agree with that. He starts off so materialistic, so desperate to seem cool and American. But through his letters, we start to see the cracks. We see his own dysfunctional family.
His relationship with his little brother, Igor, his violent father, it's all there under the surface.
And that's why that line he says early on is so ironic.
You are the hero of this story. I am only the one who is translating it for you.
Yes. Because while he insists Jonathan is the hero, Alex's own internal journey is where so much of the novel's heart is.
But there is a critique there, right? That the humor around Alex might risk exoticizing the Ukrainian perspective for a Western audience.
That's a fair question, but I think Fore uses that comedic filter as a very specific narrative tool. Alex's voice is the sound of a modern person trying to process a history that is just too big for him.
So it's a way of showing his own generational trauma.
I think so. The silence and violence in his own home are an echo of the larger historical silence his community has maintained. And by the end, the act of telling the story becomes his own form of heroism.
Which brings us, of course, to the grandfather, the tragic figure, Alexander Perchoff.
Yeah.
He's crude, he's antagonistic, and he claims to be blind.
And that feigned blindness is one of the most powerful symbols in the entire book. It's not physical, it's a psychological refusal to see.
He's refusing to acknowledge a moment from his past.
A catastrophic moment. He is the living embodiment of suppressed, unbearable memory. He's the poison in both the contemporary journey and, as we discover, the historical one.
And that feeling of impending doom is just amplified by the magical realist history of Trockenbrod.
Yes, Fore builds this vibrant, fantastical world where love can literally change the course of a river.
An idol.
A complete idol. He builds it up just to make its destruction feel not just tragic, but metaphysically immense, like the crushing of an entire universe, not just a village.
And then the structure just pivots. The road trip goes deeper into this desolate landscape, and the humor starts to fade.
It gives way to this intense shared unease. They're on a pilgrimage into a landscape of ghosts.
And the two narratives finally collide. Jonathan's historical story reaches its climax with the Nazi invasion and the complete obliteration of the shtetl.
And at the same time, the trio arrives at the physical location of Trockenbrod, which is just an empty field.
But it's not entirely empty. They find Lista, the sole survivor.
Living in this remote house, curating a makeshift museum of everything that was lost, she's the keeper of the raw, unvarnished facts, and she delivers the final devastating truth.
She reveals that, yes, Jonathan's grandfather, Safran, did escape, but the woman in the photograph wasn't Augustine. It was Lista herself.
And then the most agonizing twist of all, the grandfather, Alex's grandfather, is the one whose guilt has been driving this entire story.
Lista tells them the core secret. During the massacre, the Nazi commander forced a young Alexander Perchoff to point out his best friend, a Jewish man named Herschel.
And he did. He pointed him out, and Herschel was executed on the spot.
It's all articulated in that one raw confession. He was my best friend, and I killed him.
And that single impossible choice, made in a moment of sheer terror, has defined the grandfather's entire existence. All that bitterness, all that cruelty.
Yeah.
It was just the surface of this profound, unrelenting guilt.
The aftermath is just tragically swift. A few days after Jonathan leaves, the grandfather commits suicide.
And he leaves behind that note: I am not a bad person. I am a good person who has done one bad thing.
Such a painfully ambiguous line. It really gets to the heart of the novel's moral complexity.
It does. The book refuses to give you an easy judgment. It asks how a person can live with a choice like that. Does one terrible act destroy a lifetime?
And in clinging to that idea that he was still a good person, he reveals how necessary self-justification is for survival, even right up to the end.
But the ending is in total despair. Alex's story finds a point of hope.
Right. He confronts his abusive father. He chooses to break that cycle of violence and silence that was rooted in his grandfather's trauma.
And the structure reflects that partial resolution. Alex and Jonathan exchange final letters, cementing this bond they forged. And the novel's very last lines go back to Jonathan's fictional history, stopping right on the edge of the massacre.
The horror is illuminated, it's understood, but it's not fully narrated. It leaves us in that unspeakable gap. So that brings us right to the themes. The first has to be the relationship between truth and storytelling.
Absolutely. The novel argues that history isn't static. It's a fluid narrative we're constantly constructing. Jonathan's mythical Trockenbrod, Alex's letters, they show that remembering is also an act of creating.
And the illumination is that collision. It's when the romantic past we want meets the unbearable reality Lista provides.
And Fore seems to be saying that real healing doesn't come from finding a perfect factual story. It comes from accepting the messiness, the ambiguity, and taking responsibility for how we choose to tell it.
And we have to talk about generational trauma. It's not just about the grandfather's actions, it's about the ripples of silence that follow.
Exactly. The unspoken horrors fester. Jonathan's obsession, Alex's family dysfunction, the grandfather poisoning his own life, it all stems from that one central unaddressed wound.
It's a powerful statement about how the silence we inherit in our own families, whether from huge historical events or private tragedies, can shape us. And confronting those truths is the only way to forge a real connection in the present.
And that's where the magical realism comes in so powerfully. By showing us a world where love literally transforms reality, Four gives us this heartbreaking measure of what human hatred was capable of destroying. It elevates the lost world to a mythic status,
which makes its destruction feel even more catastrophic.
The novel's real power is in that emotional shift. It moves from the charm and comedy of Alex's voice to this profound contemplative sadness. It reminds us that immense tragedy is always composed of individual, personal stories. Stories of love, betrayal, and a single impossible choice.
This novel is just such a powerful testament to how innovative literary structures can serve these deeply humanistic purposes. It proves that formal experimentation and emotional connection can and should go hand in hand.
It leaves us with a real challenge, you know, that while we can't change the past, we can absolutely change our relationship to it, and that changed relationship is the only real path toward healing. This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.